Today's Taisho will be on Case 61 in the Book of Serenity, John Fong's 1. Introduction. A roundabout explanation is easy to understand. It imparts with one hand. A direct explanation is hard to understand. It opens up in all dimensions. I urge you not to use clear speech, for if speech is clear, getting out of it is more difficult. If you don't believe, let's try to bring this up. A monk asked John Fong, "The blessed ones of the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of Nirvana. Where is that road?" John Fong drew a line in the air with his staff and said, "It is here." The monk asked Yunmen the same question. Yunmen said, "The fan leaps up to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose. The carp of the eastern sea is hit once with the stick, and it rains buckets. Do you understand? Do you understand?" Verse. Starting in, it turns out he uses medicine for a dead horse. The reviving incense is about to cause you peril. If all your life you squeeze out sweat through your body, only then will you believe he didn't spare his eyebrows. Thank you all very much for coming today to practice this beautiful path of Chan, or Zen. I hope you had a good sit this morning. I hope you had a wonderful sit. Or perhaps you were working through your obstacles. Either way, it's really wonderful to be able to practice this path. And I'm very glad you could be here today. I was recently speaking with somebody who came to see me in my office about stress. This person is a computer expert, and he does indeed have a terrible job. He's responsible for a number of computer facilities in the humanities. I mean, quite a large number. And I think it's something like 14 sites. And he used to have two assistants and some student assistants, but one of his assistants quit and went to Thailand. So he has one assistant and the student assistants. And in our department, there has been some unhappiness with this guy's work. Because people, English professors, there are many English professors who know even less about computers than I do, which is hard to believe, but it's true. And so when something goes wrong, they don't try to figure it out. They become helpless and fall on the ground, and then they call this guy, right? Just as I do, right? He's constantly telling people, I'll get to it as soon as I can. And of course, if your computer, people are so dependent on their computers that if you can't get your email, or if, some other problem is arising, you feel totally paralyzed and helpless. And then you begin to direct your hostility at the computer expert, right? Nobody says, or very few people say, "Gee, I should know more about computers." You know, it's much easier to say, "Ah, that guy." You know, it's also very easy for people who are on the receiving end of services not to appreciate how difficult it is to provide those services. My grandfather was I think I'm sensitive to this because my grandfather was a car repair person. He was a mechanic. And sometimes we would go to visit my grandfather in his shop. And sometimes there would be a customer there arguing with my grandfather about his bill, you know. I myself take my car to a place, a GT Japanese Automotive in Edison. And I'll come in there sometime and there's a customer arguing with the mechanics about the bill. And it reminds me of going into my grandfather's shop when I was a little boy. My grandfather was an honest mechanic. I think he was a very honest man, and the mechanics I take my car to are very honest men. And yet people argue with him and get very upset. And I thought that this computer person in the humanities was being treated the same way. You know, people who don't understand his difficulties are blaming him for a failure to do what is really an impossible job. And whenever there's been public discussion about this guy, I've stuck up for him and I've said, you know, I think he's doing an excellent job. He's very knowledgeable. He just has, he's overwhelmed, and we're going to hire another person to help him. The point is, he came in to see me in my office and he complained about the stress he's under. And he said, "What is this Zen anyway?" And I was so happy to explain. But I think he is going to come and sit with us. At least I'm hoping. I thought he might come last night, but he may still come. And I'm hoping, because I think it really will help him. It certainly has helped me a lot in my life. You know, one of the things that was sort of a sticking point is that, you know, the element of effort and time, the elements of effort and time. You know, when he came in and he said, "What is this Zen?" I think he was hoping I would say, "Well, here's all you have to do, you know, 3 minutes a day and you're on your way, right? And, you know, just do this, put this leg on this, finger on your nose, you know. And boom, you know, say Shazam, and you'll be there. Do that once a month, and perfect." So I said, "Well, you know, if you want to do this, here's what I would recommend: you come to sit with us once a week, and you try to do this to start with twice a week, and try to increase your practice until you're doing this quite often, and et cetera." And now this is a person I understand who's under incredible time pressures, right? I mean, he has all of this pressure, and here I'm telling him, please carve out of your life some additional time to do meditation practice. And so when he didn't show up on Friday night, I was not entirely surprised, but I honestly think that if he comes to do Zen, he'll be more efficient in his work, and he'll be able to continue his work with a much better attitude. He'll be able to continue to find a sort of a happiness or joy in what he has to do. You know, otherwise, there's this danger that it's just going to be overwhelming, and he's going to be quite unhappy with his job. But he's not the only person I've talked to recently who's been a little surprised about how much time Zen requires. I was talking to somebody else about this who also expressed an interest in Zen, and the person asked me how much time I practice. And I told him the truth, which is that, you know, I get up in the morning and I try to sit. I sit for at least an hour, and I try to sit for a little more. Sometimes I sit for 2 hours, especially in the summer when I have a little more time. And I do that pretty much every day, unless I have to drive somewhere to sit, and then I sit there. I also sit at night, pretty much everywhere we have a sit, and that's about an hour and a half. So that's something like 10 hours in the morning and 10 hours in the evening, which is not essential for Zen practice, but that's my life, you know. And I told this person, and he was just astounded, right, that I spent, you know, that's like a 20-hour week doing Zazen. Then I began to think about it, you know. That is remarkable. You know, if you do 7 hours, if you do an hour in the day, in the morning, and an hour at night, that's 14 hours a week. And then there's a, let's say you take 2 weeks off, but there's 50, say you do 20 hours a week. That's, well, let's say 14. And then there's 50 weeks in a year, right? So and I've been doing this for 30 years. So that conservative estimate, right? Because Sesshin and other things. So I would guess, so
that's 30,000 hours.
That's quite a commitment, wouldn't you say? I was sitting here this morning, and I was actually thinking about this morning too, and then I realized, you know, I actually regret that I haven't done more sitting. I really am telling you the truth. You know, this morning I had just this wonderful sit. I was like in heaven. And I was sitting here thinking, you know, I wish I'd done more of this. You know, I wish I'd started earlier, and I wish I'm glad I'm relatively young, because I have many years of sitting ahead of me. You know, when I say things like that, when I say I had a wonderful sit this morning and so on, please don't think that I'm boasting, because it has nothing to do with me at all, you know. It has to do with Zen. I'm telling you how it is, you know. If you practice long enough, you just work through most of your karmic obstacles. It's not hard to do, you know, especially if you're working with koans. You know, koans force you to confront your karmic obstacles. It's very hard if you're doing koan practice to hide your karmic obstacles, your fears, your attachments, your anxieties, your expectations. It's very hard to hide those from yourself. Koans are very clever at pulling those out and forcing you to confront them. And if you are doing koan practice for 15 years or so, you're working through a lot of your obstacles. And then, you know, basically it becomes possible to sit on the cushion and be a really simple person. You know, simplicity is very difficult for human beings, but if you practice long enough, it's possible to sit on the cushion and just be in the pure presence of the moment. And it's pure joy. It's just pure joy. And you know, all your anxieties, all your fears, all your dreams, all your nightmares are all sort of like gone. You know, it's all in the past. It's all, you know, old news. And a pure presence of the moment is just like is heaven itself. It's absolutely beautiful. So I'm not boasting. This is nothing special. Anybody who does this works his or her way towards this condition. And it's absolutely, there's no such thing as a talent for Zen. There's no such thing as, you know, special beings. You know, in some traditions they mention that some people are reincarnated. But, you know, really, everybody's, if you want to think about it, everybody's part of the same fabric of existence. You know, we're all in a certain way reborn over and over again, you know. So nothing special about tulkus in the tradition of the Tibetan Buddhism. And so they're just ordinary people. The Dalai Lama is not deeply awakened because he's the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama. He's deeply awakened because he spent, he makes my
30,000 hours
on the cushion look like nothing, look like amateur, right? Because he's been doing this since he was about 12. And so he must have, you know, a million hours on the cushion. He gets up every day, and I understand he does 4 hours of meditation. It's not how many hours you do, it's not the point. But if you just keep going up to Mu Xin, to the wall of Mu, and your obstacles, your troubles, your fears arise, you know, little by little, you work through them. And we all have a lifetime's accumulation of our fears and anxieties and injuries that have been done to us. And so it takes us all many years. It's unrealistic to imagine that a little sitting is going to take it all, sweep it all away. It takes, especially with things that are very deeply ingrained, it takes many years of practice to free yourself. So, you know, I used to have, I don't think I do anymore, but I used to have like a really bad temper. I don't mean I was a mean person, I don't think that was true, but I had a temper. And I think it's because my father was quite a harsh disciplinarian. My father was a military man. And basically, he believed very strongly in like corporal punishment. You know. So my brother and I were always getting, you know, punished, corporal punishment. And it used to really make me outrageously angry, you know, because you know, there's something wrong with a 6'3", 200-pound man beating up a little kid. You know, there's something wrong. It's like an injustice. And that experience of helplessness is quite sickening and difficult to overcome. So, you know, when I was an adult, I didn't think much about it. I actually sort of put it out of my mind. And then, you know, as I began to do Zen practice, I was really trying to become a deeply enlightened being. And I wasn't particularly concerned about my karmic obstacles. I wanted to have mystic experiences, mystical experiences. I didn't want to confront my own problems, you know. So I would sit on the cushion and work with my koan, trying to have a mystical experience. And every once in a while, I would come home from my sit and find that I was very angry. And my wife would say, you know, what are you so angry about? And of course, I wanted to be like the Dalai Lama, so I would say, angry, I'm not angry. You know? But I was angry, you know. I'd be angry at the cat, or I'd be angry at the oranges on the table, you know. And that wasn't the image of myself that I wanted to have. I didn't want to see myself as an angry person. Because the Dalai Lama is not an angry person, right? Buddha is not an angry person. So I wanted to be serene and always loving and kind, which is a good goal, but unfortunately I had all of this stuff locked up inside of me. So at one point I was working with a koan, and it's not this koan, I'd rather not talk about what koan it was, but it became apparent to me that I had a lot of anger to deal with. It took me a long time to see it because I didn't want to see it. I kept sitting on the cushion trying to have a mystical experience when the answer was right under my nose, you know, that the answer to this particular koan for me was that I'm outraged because my father used to, you know, beat me up. And, of course, I loved my father, but you know, there was something really screwed up about this, yeah? So you know, it took me a long time to work that through. Even after you answer a koan, it's not like it ceases to bother you completely, right? After you confront an obstacle by working with a koan, and you have a kind of a clearing, you know, you're not totally clear, necessarily. So what I mean by this is, you know, maybe you're working on a koan and you suddenly find you're getting angry all the time. And then suddenly you realize that you're angry. And then you realize that this anger comes from somewhere, right? You keep coming back to Mu, keep coming back to Mu, you keep coming back to Mu, and, you know, maybe the anger gets worse for a while. You know, you just, when you sit, you're like a blaze of anger, or you're like very sad, or you're, you know, whatever your particular karmic obstacle is. And, you know, you work with this for a long time, you know, and one day you sit on the cushion and the anger's gone, and you're cool and calm, like a lake, in a beautiful summer lake on a windless day. Right? Your mind is just like that lake. That's beautiful. You know, you've worked through your karmic obstacle, right? And that's a wonderful moment. But you know, you may find that it's not completely clear. You know, later you might see, oh, there's the anger again. I thought I had cleared that up. So it can take many years of practice before you begin to really get through some of these, depending on your karma. You know, depending on your particular karma, may take many years before you become a simple person. You know, a simple person. And that's really, in some ways, the goal of Zen practice, is somebody who's able to be in the moment with its simplicity. And being a simple person takes great tender-heartedness, great vulnerability and tender-heartedness. You know, because we've been injured many times, and so we don't necessarily want to have that kind of simplicity and that kind of openness. And simplicity is a mark of trust, right? You know, just to be in the moment shows a great trust in life. You know. So anyway, this is the Zen. This is a sort of like a lot of Zen practice involves this process of working through our karmic obstacles. And being able to do that itself requires a great deal of practice. So before you can work through your karmic obstacles, you have to have one pointed mind. So working with the breath is absolutely essential. If you can't stabilize your attention, and you can't be focused on the moment, you can't accomplish anything. So the first stage of Zen practice, the development of one-pointed mind and samadhi, is absolutely crucial. And that may take a year. Some students who are not very promising may take as much as 5 years to work through the breath koan. And I know this because I was that student. You know. It took me a long time not able to be in the moment very easily. Breath perception, susokukan, is not like a baby koan. It's the foundation of all practice. And if you can develop a powerful mental focus, if you can be in samadhi deeply, there's nothing you can't accomplish. And my feeling is that many Zen teachers neglect this early stage of Zen practice, the mental stabilization part. And they don't, everybody wants to rush into mu, but you know, breath perception is quite crucial. It's absolute, being able to enter deep samadhi is quite important and a great asset in your practice. So that could take anywhere between, say, a few months and a few years on average. And then, of course, you begin to do the mu koan, which is confronting shunyata, or emptiness. And becoming one with it. This can take maybe anywhere between a couple years and 6 years, say. I have known people who have been doing the Mu Koan for 10 years. Yeah? So at any rate, then you begin to enter the realm of clearing away karmic obstacles. And that's long, takes a long time. Because, you know, when somebody has a koan, we think at first, you know, oh boy, I'm going to have enlightenment, right? You know, or I'm going to have a mystical experience. But then you begin to work with the koan and you begin to confront your obstacles. And then it's like shoveling dirt, right? You have to move the pile of dirt from here to here, right? So it's just you roll up your sleeves and you have to it may take a number of years, you know. Generally speaking, we're talking about a sizable commitment of time. And this is for people who are doing regular sesshin, right? This is not just for people who are practicing on a daily basis, but people who are doing sesshin quite regularly. So if you're doing sesshin and you're practicing on a regular basis, Zen practice can take you 10, 15 years to complete. If you sit once a month, you know, you're not really doing Zen practice. And if you don't do sesshin, actually not really doing Zen practice. That's not Zen practice. You can get many benefits from just doing zazen. You know, it helps your mental health. It helps your physical health. But basically, the whole package is required if your goal is awakening. The point is that Zen practice requires a lot of time and effort. And you have to make a place for this in your life. And if you don't, nothing's going to happen. And this requires a sacrifice, right? Because I've probably done more than
30,000 hours
of zazen in my life. I've done 5 to 7 sesshin for 30 years. So that's somewhere between 150 sesshin and 210 sesshin. Okay. So I'm doing better than
30,000 hours
of sitting. Now, in those hours, I could have done a lot of things, right? But I decided to sit. And I personally regret that I haven't done more sitting. And this morning, it was pretty good, you know. Really good. I swear to you, look, there's no charge for the service, right? I'm not asking any payback of any kind. But I'm just telling you the truth. This Zen is pretty great. Pretty great. So I think
30,000 hours
is a small price to pay for the way I feel when I sit, because I'm a very happy man, really and truly. The element of Zen I wanted to get to was it requires commitment. It requires patience, and it requires time to mature. It's like a tree takes time to go from an acorn to a mighty oak. And if you want to become an awakened person, it takes time and effort and careful nurturing, right? You nurture your practice just like you would take care of a little oak tree, you know? You water it every day, and it would grow into this mighty oak that would shelter and feed all these living beings, all these sentient beings. This is a path of the bodhisattva. So necessary to make sacrifices. On the other hand, you know, it's also necessary to engage with the world. And also necessary to engage with the world. So you know, if you're going to do zazen, you kind of have to close the door on the world, right? A little bit. You have to say, I'm sorry, but I'm going to go home now. It's 10 o'clock, and I'm going to go to sleep because I get up at 4:30 and do my zazen. And they'll say, but the party's just started, right? And if you want to stay, stay, you know. But don't do it every night, right? You know? I myself just get tired at 10:30, and I say, well, it was a lovely party, thank you. You know, I hate to eat and run, but I'm going to go home now. And I go to sleep, and I get up at 4:30, and I do my zazen. And this goes on for many days. So some elements of closing the door, right? You say, listen, the world is a nice place, but it's crazy. It's crazy. And it's unhappy, and it's violent, right? It is. It's all of those things, right? You meet wonderful people in the world, but on the whole, you know, if we don't blow ourselves up, right, it will be a miracle, right? And that's a truth. When I was a little boy, I used to lie in bed at night waiting for the nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and I would hear jet planes flying over our house and think that's probably the missile, right? And that was in the 60s when I was a little boy. And that day is over for now, but not over forever, right? And it's not an accident. The world is a violent and unhappy place. People are haunted by illusion, and it drives them to make millions, it drives them to kill, it drives them to do all kinds of crazy things. But generally speaking, the world's a madhouse in a lot of ways, in spite of its many good features. And so we Zen people, we close the door, and we sit down on the cushion, and we return to basic sanity, right? Okay. And that is a sacrifice, because those 300 hours could be spent doing something else. Okay. But on the other hand, you know, it's a very important to open the door again and go out into the world. This is like a very, very important aspect of practice also. Right? So some people who come to Sesshin are a little bit surprised the first time. And by the way, if you haven't come to Sesshin, you're really missing something wonderful. Really. Because it's really a wonderful experience. Talk to anybody who's done it. And basically, you know, you come to Sesshin, and on day one of Sesshin, you're still thinking about all your stuff, all your stuff. You're thinking, what am I doing here? I've got to finish that report. This is crazy, you know. By the end of the first day, you're thinking, well, this wasn't so bad. You know, everybody was talking about how difficult this was. I think I'm going to be okay. You get up day two, and suddenly you sit on the cushion, and it's like, uh-oh. You know, those muscles, after 8 hours of meditation, those muscles are sore. They're full of lactic acid, right? They hurt. Your back is tired. People generally don't like getting up at 4:30 if they get up at the crack of 10 every day, right? So it's rough, you know. But by around day three, people begin to enter deeper mind. Mind begins to stabilize, become calm and focused. And people go through a change. You know, by the end of Sesshin, when people leave Sesshin, their faces are clear and bright. They look years younger because they've encountered fundamental nature. You could say original nature. Yeah, it's a beautiful experience. Beautiful. It really does make you younger. Really, totally young. And then you're done your Sesshin, and you have to, you know, so there's a process to Sesshin. There's a process. You come in, and you have to climb up the mountain. And it takes about 3 days to climb up the mountain. And it's tough. It's a slog. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, I hope I can stay. You know, the first couple of Sesshin, on day two, people are thinking, should I go? You know, do I have the strength to stay? You know, I remember, you know. And you climb up to the top of the mountain, and around day three, suddenly there's like this change. Generally speaking, people feel better, they have more energy, they feel more alive, the mind is clear and calm. And it's wonderful, it's like an infusion of life energy. And then Sesshin ends, you know, so you go through this process. Then you get in your car and you drive home and you go to sleep and you have a nice sleep and you don't have to get up at 4:30 the next day. So you sit, you get up a little later and you go to work, maybe. And the first thing, you know, it's the madness again, right? It's the craziness again. And for a long time you sit at your, you know, a long time, for many years, basically. After Sesshin, you have like a after Sesshin experience where you, You just think, oh my gosh, I wish I were back. Maybe this hasn't happened to you, but eventually it will. You know, the first couple of years, you know, you're sitting in Sesshin's thinking, I want to get out of here, right? But eventually what happens is, you know, you're sitting at your desk and you're thinking, man, I wish I were back at Sesshin, where it was calm and sane. And I see this all the time. People go through this change. There are people who have come to Sesshin who literally were like jumping out of their clothes the first couple of Sesshins. It was like they couldn't sit still to save their lives, you know? And at this last Sesshin, there was somebody like that. Years ago, this person, it was like, if somebody were moving in the Zendo, I knew who it was during Sesshin, you know? This last Sesshin, this person's sitting there, his like a smile on his face the whole Sesshin, very serene. And said, how's it going? Wonderful, right? Wonderful. And I'm so happy for this person. And I'm so happy. But, you know, you come out of that state, that beautiful state, and you hit your, you're on the, you know, Garden State Turnpike, right? Somebody cuts you off. I went in after the Sesshin to get gas, you know. And somebody gave me a hard time in the gas station. He was rude to me and everything. It's like, you know, welcome back to New Jersey land, right? You know, this is right after Sesshin. I actually was laughing, you know. I don't think the guy knew why I was laughing. He was so rude, it was funny, you know. It was not like funny. It's like, and you think, well, this is so terrible, you know. This is what happened to my beautiful, calm mind. And it is hard to make that adjustment. See, but that's also part of the process. See, that's also part of the process. When the Buddha, in sutra, there's a sutra that I really am fond of out of the early sutras. It's the Arya Pariya Sana Sutta, okay? The Noble Search Sutra. And the Buddha describes his whole life. It's a great sutra. In fact, Richard Ferris, one of our members, was kind enough to read the whole sutra, and it's now on it's on the Zen Practice website at the bottom of the page. You could download it and listen to it in the car as you drive to work if you wanted to. But the Buddha talks about, in the sutra, he tells the story of how he studied with these meditation teachers, and how he had his great awakening, and so on. But one of the interesting things is that he describes his great awakening experience. Immediately after his great awakening experience, it's like the end of Sesshin, right? You know, he has this great awakening, and then and by the way, the Buddha's great awakening lasted for 7 days. According to the sutras, he entered enlightened mind, and he didn't stop sitting for 7 days. At the end of 7 days, he stopped sitting. And at that time, he got off the cushion, and it occurred to him, he was immediately struck by like post-Sesshin awareness, right? And he said, basically, you know, what I have just done is very difficult to achieve. And it requires great mental subtlety and clarity and open-heartedness. And when I look at the world, I think, you know, how am I ever going to explain this to anybody in a way that they're going to understand? Because the world is absolutely crazy, right? This is just like people coming out of Sesshin. The Buddha's just encountered enlightened mind, right? He's just had this fundamental experience of fundamental reality and a boundless compassion. All his karmic obstacles swept away. Okay? Motionless for, you know, if we sit for an hour and a half, that's quite a strain, right? The Buddha sat for 7 days without moving in enlightened mind. At the end of it, he thinks, my gosh, you know, this world is a crazy place. How could I ever communicate this? And then, according to the sutra, this has a mythological dimension. Deva named Brahma Sahampati appears to the Buddha like a god. And he says, you know, if you don't do something, you know, if you don't do something, then all is lost, you know, because the people are really screwed up, you know, and the world really needs your efforts. And so it's like a little poem, basically, in the sutra. And he says, arise, you know, a victorious hero, deathless one, and wander the world. Let the Buddha teach the Dharma. There will be those who understand. And so then the Buddha says, okay, I'll do it. And for the next 45 years, he gets up every morning and does his meditation. And he goes out and he begs for his food. And then he just teaches, right? And he lives through famines and wars. And every waking minute is spent assisting other people. And that's the Buddha's life. And then he dies when he's in his 80s. And this is like a wonderful story because it's pointing to something. It's pointing to something which is so important, you know. Buddha's enlightenment would not be complete if it just stopped with the Buddha's enlightenment, right? That wouldn't be all-embracing. It has to include everything, right? So you know, part of the Buddha's enlightenment takes place in those 7 days, but the other part of the Buddha's enlightenment takes place in those 45 years that followed those 7 days, as he's trying to help person after person free himself from the fires of samsara, of the misery we create for ourselves through the complexities of the human mind, right? And these two things are not opposed, you know. They're part of a greater whole. You know, every time you encounter an obstacle, it gives you the opportunity to wake up more deeply. You know, I don't even personally think that the Buddha's enlightenment stopped after 7 days. In other words, many people think that Buddha achieved complete, total enlightenment after 7 days. But you know, actually, according to the sutras, the Buddha did meditation on other occasions. On a number of other occasions, he entered this deep state of awakening. So apparently, there's like 5 or 6 times in his life where he sat like this for 7 days and entered a deeply awakened mind, had like a 5 or 6 Daikensho experiences. I think his learning process also continued. Yeah. So you get off the cushion and you go out to your job and you have a problem that day, and then you come back to the cushion and you work it through, and the mind is deeper, clearer, brighter, more open. You know, so these obstacles help us wake up. It's a big mistake to think that the best place to practice Zen is on the mountaintop. You know, it's a big mistake. You know, the kind of practice we have right here in our community is in some ways the best. I think this is just what the Buddha imagined, right? You know, we get up. We do our zazen, we go to school, we go to our job, we have problems, we sit on the cushion, and you know, you come to sit and you want to enter bliss, right? But you sit on the cushion and there are all your problems. And you go back to mushin and you enter that blankness, and little by little you work through all those problems. And you know, after that happens, the mind is brighter, calmer, sweeter, more joyous than it ever could have been without the problems. So it's like that's real unity, right? That's real unity. Everything is enlightened mind. You know, it doesn't seem that way, so it takes a lot of sitting. But you know, no matter what the obstacle, if you keep practicing, it opens up into enlightened mind. No matter what it is, you know, even cancer, even auto accident. So you know, please don't think that you know, you could go to Tibet if you want, sit on a mountain. And but you know, I really don't think you would have a richer practice environment, richer experience of meditation practice than you can have right here in New Jersey, right here in our little sangha. As far as I'm concerned, all the tools are right here to work with. You know, you have zazen, you have problems. You have a community of wonderful people who support one another in the practice. You know, that's about all you need, right? Beautiful. A monk asked John Fong, "The blessed ones of the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of Nirvana. Where is that road?" John Fong drew a line in the air with his staff and he said, "It's right here." Right? It's right here. Now the problem with that answer is that most people know it intellectually, but they don't experience it, right? You know, that it's very difficult for people to encounter, to say, okay, it's right here. We say it, you know, we say it and then we don't believe it, right? Immediately we start looking somewhere else for it, right? This is just human nature. And so we have to do a lot of zazen. That's the way it is. And so basically, John Fong is a great Zen master and he's very direct. You know, the guy said, the monk asked John Fong, "Where is it?" And John Fong says, "Right here, right here." That's a beautiful answer. Now, Yunmen has a different answer, because Yunmen maybe has a different, he knows that most people aren't going to believe that. If you say, "You're Buddha," it's like, "Oh yeah, great, you know, I'm Buddha, sure. So how come I'm so angry? So how come I'm so, you know, unhappy? So how come I'm so, you know, blah, blah, blah." Okay, fine. You're not Buddha right now. So Yunmen knows, okay, I won't tell you it's right here. Let me give you a koan that you're going to have to work through, and then you'll discover that it's right here. See, Yunmen's really like clever. So he says, okay, where is it? And Yunmen says, okay, let me tell you. The fan leaps up to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose, right? So it's very mysterious, right? Where is it? It's in Tibet, of course, right? It's in a mystic mountain monastery deep in Tibet. See, it's far away, very mysterious, very difficult to find. See, it's up in the gods, the realm of the gods. You know. So a fan goes up to the realm of the gods and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose, right? There's a carp in the eastern sea. The carp of the eastern sea is hit with a stick and it rains buckets. See, very difficult, very mysterious, very far away. See, that's a good koan. Because then people say, okay, it's far away, I've got to find it, right? And you sit, and you sit, and you sit, and you think, where could it be, where could it be, where could it be, right? 10 years later, you go, oh my God, it's right here. See? Oh my God, it's been here all along. Why didn't I see it? Well, we all have fears, we all have illusions, we have to work through them, right? So if you don't believe it's right here, no problem. Just get back on your cushion. Everything will be wonderful. Do you understand? Do you understand? Starting in, it turns out he uses medicine for a dead horse. Right? Everything is Buddha. Everything is your medicine. All your fears are illusions, are just illusions. The reviving incense is about to cause you peril. If all your life you squeeze out sweat through your body, only then will you believe he didn't spare his eyebrows, right? So It's just human nature. We are in the midst of a Buddha, paradise itself, and yet just have to do a little zazen to experience that, because we can't quite believe it, but it's true. So today we all, could have done many things today. You could have gotten up and listened to a car talk. You could have partied till 3 in the morning, 3 a.m. I assume you didn't do that. Could have stayed in bed and had a Dunkin' Donuts, but you got up and you came here. Because I think you were listening to your true self. And so thank you for serving your true self so well. And I look forward to our next opportunity to do this together.